Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Port of Harlem Talk Radio. You can also visit portofharlem.net and click on Port of Harlem Talk Radio from the menu to hear this and past episodes. Our next guest is University Archivist at Morgan State University, Dr. Ida Jones, and author of Baltimore Civil Rights Leader, Victorine Q. Adams. Jones is also a life member of the Association for the Study of African-American Life and History, sometimes called ASALA, and a member of the Bethel Duke branch of ASALA. Welcome, Dr. Jones.
Thank you, and good evening, Mr. Young.
Yes, you know, I noticed your branch is named for Bethel Dukes. Are each of the branches named for a person? And if so, why not? And who was Bethel Dukes?
That's an excellent question. As the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, birthed by Carter G. Woodson in 1915, sought to celebrate, acknowledge, and preserve and promote Africana history, the branches were the tentacles that would be doing the work 365, while the national organization would have two anchor events, a Black History Month luncheon and an annual conference. So the branches are the local repositories of the vision of the national organization. And most branches have selected the names of individuals, both nationally or internationally, prominent or locally prominent and relevant. The Bethel Dukes branch is named after our founding person, Mr. Bethel Dukes, and his wife, Picola Dukes. They used to meet by couples. So there were about 5 to 6 married couples who used to meet to do the work of the association. And they used to be called the Far Northeast Southeast Branch. And when Mr. Dukes passed away, I want to say in the late 1990s, they thought it honorable to name the branch after him and change it from the Far Northeast Southeast Branch to the Bethel Dukes Branch.
Interesting. And I think D.C. had more than one branch, because you're saying the Far Northeast and Far Southeast. And for those who don't live in Metro D.C., she's talking about only a portion of D.C. So were there other branches in D.C.?
Yes, there are 4 quadrants in D.C., Northwest, Southwest, Northeast, and Southeast. And we were Far Southeast, Northeast. There is in the Northwest the branch at the Shiloh Baptist Church branch, I believe, and that is at the Baptist Church that Dr. Woodson actually attended. And then there is another branch as well. I want to call it the C. Dolores Tucker branch, I believe, with Peter Bailey in the same Northwest quadrant. So there are currently 3 branches of the association operating in Washington, D.C.
Interesting. So is that normal for a city to have more than one branch?
Almost definitely. In light of the nature of how they proliferated, either out of a church organization, a fraternal organization, or some other small community, those interests would kind of be overlapping in concentric circles. So my branch is very affiliated with Howard University, and so therefore most of our membership has come through Howard University or the Episcopal Church, because I believe Mr. Dukes must have been Episcopalian. We used to meet in the Episcopal Church as well. So once again, these kinds of relationships are rather intimate circles that invite others to join but grow out of a unique similarity or kinship in terms of the membership.
Okay, so you mentioned Carter G. Woodson, of course, the father of Black History Month. He started ASALA, as you said, in 1915. I just have to note, that was 4 years before the founding of the NAACP. And since 1928, you all have been providing themes for us to focus on. The first theme was created in 1928, and it was Civilization and World Achievement. For 2021, the theme is the Black Family, Representation, Identity, and Diversity. Historically, Dr. Jones, what have these themes provided us, and what have people done with them?
Well, I'm happy that Dr. Woodson's name is getting out there and that he's getting the level of treatment he deserves in the world place, in the world marketplace of ideas. But I want to expand our understanding, not just simply the father of Black history. He's actually the father or the intellectual architect of the study of African-American history, because history is a social science. So there is actually academic training and rigors and paradigms to how it's done. So he's more than just simply celebrating in terms of flag waving about Black history. He actually creates the rubric for the deep interrogation, the scholarly interrogation of history as a social science field. So that is why, in fact, he has such a profound impact to the field of African American history in terms of what is credible, what is not credible, and how sources are to be identified and located. So that's one thing. In regards to his vision for creating the association, it was right during the wake of the film Birth of a Nation. In September 9, 1915, he met in Chicago and chartered the organization that would become the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History. Having taught at Howard University and living in Washington, D.C., and being a Baptist affiliate person as well as a member of Omega Psi Phi fraternity, he brings in a wealth of his universal world together to really bring together the mindset, not just on the academic level, but then to diffuse that through secondary schools, high schools, churches, civic and fraternal organizations, so that our entire community, from the push broom to the boardroom, would be able to understand who we are, where we came from, and how to celebrate and live that with pride.
Okay, and so what does the things done for us, and what do people
thank
do with
you.
Them?
I appreciate that. I got so lost in my own politics here, so thank you for reiterating that. So what happens as academic historians or as historians, the theme helps us to kind of focus, its laser-like focus, and to go granular on a particular topic. When you say Black history, that's just very obtuse. So we have a theme that usually is connected to an event or an activity, and so this year in particular, we were looking at the Black family. And in terms of various elements that have impacted the Black family, no one saw coronavirus coming, but that has impacted the Black family. The rise in prison rates for both men and women has also impacted the Black family, as well as economic challenges. So the whole idea of who and what the Black family is, in terms of a Western nuclear idea of two parents, male, female, children, dog, cat, fence, that has never really been the standard for African Americans. It's actually John Howard Wesley at Alfred Street Baptist Church is saying there's never been a Huxtables. No one has ever lived that fantasy. So he has a whole series talking about the Black family, and I do applaud Dr. John Howard Wesley to really kind of help us understand and kind of not mourn that, celebrate that fantasy, but understand that's not the way we're living.
Okay,
and
we're
so that
more.
Really helps us understand. Pardon?
We're going to get more into that soon, but keep
understand
going.
Yeah, that helps us to understand that we should not view ourselves as less than if we don't have a Huxtable life, or see ourselves as freakish or pathological if we don't have that life. So once again, we have to adjust our vision to our reality, and that's in terms of our inheritance, both genetically, economically, socially, civically, politically, from our ancestors, and then in our contemporary, how you're living that legacy out. And then for your future, what do you do to impart that to someone else? So I think that's a fabulous conversation we're going to have.
Yeah, and I thank you for bringing it up. But before we get further into the current theme, I do want to mention that you know the theme for 2022. And I think that's very significant because so often people have this image that somehow Black organizations or organizations led by Black people are somehow inferior when it comes to planning. But you all have the 2022 theme already set. And we won't talk about that unless you want to mention it.
Well, I'll let you mention that. I don't want to be so flag-waving proud about the association of which I am.
Well, when I saw that you all had next year planned, that made me proud. But we're going to say that for next year. But we do want to mention, though, too, that Black History Month is not just celebrated in the U.S. In February, but also in the U.K. in October and other European countries. So it has expanded to the U.K. and Europe as well.
And
there's
parts of Africa, South Africa as well. So, like I said, because he is not just simply the father of Black history, he is the intellectual architect for the field and the study of African-American or Africana people. That makes it far more ranging in terms of how other countries are going to look at how to interrogate the African life in China, Belize, Brazil, Namibia, all of that.
All of that. So what does the current... Yeah. So what does the current theme, the Black family, representation, identity, and diversity mean to you?
I think that's a very good question. What it means to me, we'll actually be having a program with the National Archives on Thursday of next week to discuss this conversation in detail. So when we look at the idea of representation, identity, and diversity, it's very important for us to understand, once again, that the African experience in North America during the era of enslavement and colonization was not that of the typical immigrant coming from Europe. There was no kind of invitation or mass welcome or even kind of respected want for us to be in this country. So that is part of it. So when you look at who and what the Black family was, it technically as an institution was not allowed to legally exist.
Exactly.
So when we look at the idea of representation, we were simply products and property of someone else. So there was no mother, father, sister, brother in terms of how the law saw us for nearly 400 years. However, we came from relationships and understanding in our pre-enslaved worlds in which there was a hierarchy. So we always maintained that dignity within the sphere as best as we could, although wives could be sold, children could be abused, murdered, and there was no crime for that. And we even see after enslavement that continues.
But when you said that, it made me think of an interview that was on CBS with the lady who just passed, 96-year-old lady, I shouldn't remember her name, but I'm having a brain freeze, Cicely Tyson.
Uh-huh.
And she was we're getting older, but, you know, we're speaking to Cicely Tyson, and she was speaking to Gail King, and she talked of how she had a conversation with a white interviewer, and he couldn't understand why, I believe in Sounder, the young actor told the older actor or referred to him as being father, and that the young guy, the white guy, couldn't even understand how even in the film there was a relationship between an older man and a younger man that could be a father-son relationship because he didn't see it as being human. And I think that's an outgrowth of what you're saying now, is that we weren't even human, so we couldn't be mother, father, et cetera.
Yes, and I actually have a quote that when Frederick Douglass talks about it, he says that genealogy was never an aspect of our relationship that we were allowed to celebrate during the enslavement process. So we know that for him, and that's Frederick Douglass, that family was very huge because his mother he did not have a formal chance to meet. But he recalls seeing in his child's mind that she reminded him of Nefertiti. So when he had seen the bust of Nefertiti, he, as a child, could remember that was my face of my mother.
Wow.
And so once again, it's so unfortunate that he was robbed of the ability to be able to have a son-mother relationship because she was on another plantation. He was taken away as an infant. And he remembers smatterings of seeing her stealing away to have visits. So the idea of what that means to a child, and of course we have all the psychology and all the records, and I don't know how traumatic that is for a child to be so, you know, neglected and so mistreated, but that was the nature of the business of chattel slavery. And so
yeah,
he talks about the idea that...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he didn't know his birthday.
And that's why the mother says, she said he remembers her calling him her little Valentine. So that's why he adopted February 14th as his birthday, because that's how he remembers his mother referring to him. I think it's a very profound thing. He talks about that in one of his biographies. So the idea of the black family, if we use the life of Frederick Douglass as a prism, or even a Mary McLeod Bethune, the 15 of 17 children born to enslaved parentage, or even your own mother having picked cotton in Arkansas in her plus 90 years, that you see that family becomes very, very important. And for African Americans, it's not just the family that's blood related. We then take it to another level of having this collective or fictive kin, whereby I would call you Brother Wayne, you might call me Sister Ida, or play cousin, or my play mother. So these terms become not just simply weapons to kind of combat this idea of being personless or non-human. It reaffirms our humanness, and it reaffirms our personhood. When I'm able to relate to someone who looks like me, who has probably had a similar situation in terms of treatment or experience, and therefore we have kinship. And that's a very African ideal, and I know I'm using that term very broadly, but African people tend to identify, like my ex-brother-in-law, the Nigerian. So I saw your sister at the train station. My sister's like, no, she's in Washington. What are you talking about? It really is my cousin. He didn't understand that term. I saw your sister. That's what he said. He referred to my cousin as my sister's sister. So I thought that was very interesting. He's a contemporary Nigerian. So I think that's interesting. That was still carrying on today.
Yeah, I think we both had the experience together at the Gambia, for instance, where people would say, well, this is my brother. And we want to know, okay, that's your brother, meaning you have the same mother and father? Or that because you have the same mother but different father? And to them, it's like, okay, it doesn't even matter. That's not the issue.
Yeah.
I love
yeah.
it.
Yeah, so that's huge.
But moving on to the U.S. Census Bureau latest report on married couple families, they say the decline between 1950 and 1991, but for married couples, decline for black families, though, from 78 to 48, but for whites from 88 to 83. So for whites, it was only a 5% drop. For blacks, it was almost a 30% drop. So what do you make of that and I think you hit on it a little bit when we talk about what a black family is, and our ideal of a mother, father, a son, and a daughter, when it hits the reality that oftentimes we don't have married coupled families in our community.
during that same window of time, that's very good that you have the data, you're going to find a surge in African-American women getting education. On the HBCU campuses, and during the 1940s and 50s, in particular during the wars, you see almost 75% of the class are women because the men have been drafted or they've gone to war. So as a result, women are going to be increasingly having opportunities, increasingly seeking education, and also doing the war efforts. Mrs. Bethune was very instrumental in getting black women into civil service and other things like that. So once again, they're now expanding their vision of what opportunity is. And you find the same thing happening right now in current day Asia, in various parts of China and Japan. Women are delaying marriage, they're delaying pregnancy because they want careers. And so how can you be, you know, a CEO and balling in the boardroom and then go home and, you know, cook and clean? And you can't be two people. So it's unfortunately, it's very hard to balance that those desires and those abilities. And some women have done it masterfully well, and God bless them because they've had husbands who might be understanding of that. But for the other part, sometimes with the war and with the economic assault on African-American men, it caused some kinds of inequity in the household in terms of, you can even look at Rock from the TV show that was in Baltimore. He's a garbage man. She's a nurse. Those are two different skill sets and two different trajectories, but they found a relationship with each other, and their family was blended, his brother and his mother living with her husband and herself. So once again, that's kind of an unusual family setting. And there were no children in that household either, which is very interesting as well. So yeah. Once again, how we define family between 1950 and 1978 is going to be radically changing in terms of traditional efforts of coupling.
Yeah, but I think that's only one aspect of it. That doesn't count for a big 30% drop when whites have only had a 5% drop. Something I think there's a lot more going on besides that for the black family to have gone through such a drastic change.
I question the numbers sometimes because I have friends who have been formally divorced but still maintain relationships, sometimes physical and emotional, with ex-partners and kind of co-raised children. I'd have to kind of look at that a little harder, but just in just a sweeping conversation about that time period, just looking at general history and understanding trends, I would believe it was the idea of deferring marriage relationships and then possibly someone having multiple relationships where they were married, divorced. And so as a result, who knows how they defined what a marriage is, like how long was a marriage viable to be considered a marriage? You know,
no, it's a
life,
married couple.
10 years,
no marriage. Yeah, we could look at the data.
Just in general, married
all
couples across the board. Okay.
But we could always look at the data different. I mean, we could always look at the data more in depth. For instance, how they define married. Well, of course, most likely it's going to be a person with a piece of paper and they're legally married. They're going to ask, are you married? And they're going to ask both the blacks and the whites the same question. But there's a 30% difference, a 25% difference. So even if there was some other kind of errors in the data collection, that's still a very large difference. And I think that's worth looking. And I think it's worth looking into, as opposed to people just not saying that it's fake.
Oh, no, I wouldn't say it's fake. I think that we have to kind of really look, interrogate the numbers and see what that means. That's a gross difference. But I definitely know there were economic issues. There was war. There was other kind of independence movements throughout the Caribbean and Africa. So there's a lot going on during that time period that would have impacted. Like even now, my demographic, never married. And those between 35 and 55, that's a very large percentage of black women who have never been married. Not that they didn't desire it, not that they didn't want. Well, where is our contemporary male counterparts? Prison, dead, being murdered. I mean, so it's very real when you look at the numbers. Not that someone didn't desire to be married, but then where is the counterpart?
Yeah, and I said there's lots and lots of things we could look into, and that could be another story for another time for Port of Harlem.
Yeah.
But the numbers are there. The numbers are there, and it's something to look into. And I don't think it's just simply saying that people were locked up or drugged out or anything of that nature, because you're still living in a community with non-blacks, and the change wasn't as great. So something is going on there that could be looked into. And I know, I guess at one point that one guy, I wouldn't say he was famous or infamous, but he brought up the question of, I guess he was saying the, was that the guy who was saying that it was somehow the black woman was ahead because some system emasculated
him? Report.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Moynihan Report in the 1960s. Yeah, the matriarchy was crushing black men. And so,
Yeah. And I don't know what happened to that report since then. I just remember it was controversial. But I don't remember the details of it anymore. But that's something to look into.
Yeah, it celebrated its 50th anniversary. Oh, yeah.
But I guess the big thing is that, you know, when you look at those realities and you celebrating the black family, that portion of it has to be part of the mix. But at the same time, the percentage of black families maintained by women with no husband present more than doubled. Much of the growth occurred between 1970 and 1980, when the proportion of such families climbed from 28 to 40%. And I know oftentimes people go and say, oh, it was something to do with the Clinton years and the rules that dealt with putting black men in prison. But Clinton didn't become president until 1991. And this
but
is
you
between
have to see
19...
him in concert with Ronald Reagan. You're going to have to see him in concert with Ronald Reagan, the whole idea of the crack epidemic. And it's not just episodic. There's a term in science fiction or called fractals. So and there's like pieces of things that eventually culminate into a bigger thing. So we can't just say, okay, the lack of black men married in 1900 is because of this reason. It's going to be pieces of elements of things that result in this larger thing.
Oh, yeah.
So you're right. Clinton was not the president of the country for the last 25 years.
Oh, I agree 100%. I'm saying people oftentimes go straight to Clinton and the war on drugs. I'm saying, like, you know, that didn't happen until 1991. This is between 1970 and 1980. It's a whole decade beforehand where the proportion of black families maintained by women with no husband present went from 28 to 40% between 1970 to 1980. And I think 1970 was probably the Carter years. I can't remember.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Ford, Carter. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So before then. So again,
but see,
that
it's
is
also building up to that. It contributed to it.
Yeah, I'm sure that will. I'm sure it didn't happen all under one person's term.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever happened, it's worth looking into why those changes took place.
And that's what we will be doing at our conference in September. We are inviting people to present papers of every academic discipline, as well as our creatives, our filmmakers, and our playwrights, to really come in and examine this, from like Lorraine Hansberry to the Moynihan Report, people such as yourself who crunch numbers, to really kind of look at this and give context to understanding the how of it, and then the how to undo it, or the how to really kind of interrogate how that affects the children.
So when
and
is
so
this,
there's a
so,
lot of impact.
So when is this conference?
Our conference will be in September, the last week of September, I want to say the 22nd to the 26th. Of September. We'll be virtual again this year. We were scheduled to be in Florida, but we are going to be doing a virtual. So we'll be going from September 22nd until September 26th of 2021. And you can learn more about asalh.org. And we are currently in our call for papers. So if you are a filmmaker, if you are a creative, if you are an academic, if you are just simply a person who has an interesting conversation, we invite you to submit a proposal to present at our conference where we can actually have these conversations and hopefully find solutions, if not build communities to create solutions, but just to simply be that change that we need.
And all these papers should center around the theme, the black family, representation, identity, and diversity. Is that correct?
Yes.
Gotcha.
Yes.
Now, you also mentioned the event that's coming up at the archive next week on the 25th. Is that going to be virtual as well?
Yes, it will be. And there is a calendar of events at NARA.org, I believe. And I will send you the link as well so you can send it out to your Port of Harlem community. But this is going to be a conversation with two authors, as well as one descendant of the Tulsa, Oklahoma riot, and another person whose family has ancestral roots on a plantation in East Texas. So we're looking at representation with two authors who wrote on the Church family. We know Mary Church Terrell. She had a half-brother named Robert Church. And so we're going to look at that conversation on that family. We're also going to be looking at John Hope Franklin's son and the Franklin family and Karen Roberts Franklin, a prominent D.C. family. They're now a married couple. So the idea of how super couples or power couples are constructed in the African-American community. And then we're going to have our speaker, Miss Barbara Dunn, whose ancestral roots go back to the Monteverde Plantation in East Texas. and talking about the roots and being able to excavate her family history on a plantation that the family still lived near and around in various parts of East Texas. So the idea of how history is so close to us and the intimacy of those families on that enslaved plantation as well. So it should be a very nice conversation.
Yeah, it sounds like a very deep conversation, a number of deep conversations. So before we close out in the next 5 minutes, what are your thoughts on how we reconcile the diversity of Black families over time and space? And we've talked about that a little bit already. In particular, in traditional African culture, it is often an extended family. In slave culture, as you mentioned, it could be the same. And now many times it can be female-headed, same-sex-headed, or mixed-race-headed. But these are often at odds with the married couple, married heterosexual ideal. And we even see, even with Vice President now, Kamala Harris, and First Gentleman Doug Emhoff, that the idea that if we want to define her as being in the Black family, that that definitely also breaks the mold of the man and the woman with locks and the two kids with locks. What's your thoughts?
That's a great question. I think the 21st century has introduced us to some realities that have always been dormant. I mean, Women of Brewster Place by Gloria Naylor had two women who were living together. They were called, I forget the term that she referred, or what the term she referred to them as. So there's always been these alternate communities of people. What has happened is we have just chosen to ignore them. And that's collectively, not just simply African Americans. But now that the kind of the scales are off our eyes, and the iceberg of reality is getting smaller, we can't afford to ignore anybody anymore. Because as much as you're finger-pointing about something you find funny or awkward, look behind your four fingers and someone in your family is living that same kind of way. So all the things we thought were odd and foreign really are, in fact, much closer to home than they have been in the past. So it's forcing us all to reckon with our own inner demons and our own sense of personal contempt that makes us feel a need to kind of laud ourselves over other people. So especially with the LGBT community, for African Americans, as you've explained in various programs and writings in the Port of Harlem, that they are a community of people who feel very spurned by Black people. I remember as a child some kind of maltreatment that some people received because of their sexual orientation, or let me say mannerisms. I don't know who they are sleeping with. So mannerisms and behavior. So we've got to move past these things in which we see, quote, fair game as, you know, someone who can be fair game, even to the people who are large. People who might be considered overweight, the whole idea of no body shaming and body affirming. So everything is now changing in terms of who is the outsider, who is the person we can kind of, you know, tease. All that's really starting to change in terms of acceptance of the other, and that different and other are not less than. And that's huge. That's actually changing Western nomenclature, because Western nomenclature tells us if you're different, then you're less. If you're other, you're less. And we have adopted these behaviors and language patterns. But now we're learning that difference is just different. Other is just other. It's not less than.
Yeah, I think it's interesting now to watch so many commercials now on television. And you can see, for instance, a grandparent who obviously looked European or white. And then he picked up this mixed race child. And you go, okay, I got that. Or you see a child running to two women. And you go, oh, I got that. And, you know, like I said, now you see the first family or the second family. And you see that, too,
exactly.
Doesn't fit the typical family picture. So I think we're all getting used to everything.
It's not going to be an easy ask. And everyone's not going to agree, but it's going to be our reality.
I think it is our reality, is that people are still learning how to deal with it. And I think at least this time around, people weren't so vicious. I mean, sometimes we were vicious, but they weren't so vicious when they started to examine the second family. You know, we know she's called Mamala, but let's leave it at that. So that's what she does. That's what they call her, and that's what she accepts. Move on. So I'm looking forward to see how inclusive you all are going to be with the Black Family Representation, Identity, and Diversity. It's happening this year. And can you give the web address again for Asala?
Yes, it's asalh.org, O-R-G, asalh.org.
Okay, Ida, so I'm so glad that you took time to share with me such thoughts, and it made me a little bit more appreciative of the fact that we came here on boats where we weren't even considered families or humans, and that And that's the roots of our beginnings, in this country at least. So, again, we're at portofharlem.net, and there you will find links to Asala and to Ida Jones's latest book. And we thank you for listening to Port of Harlem Talk Radio. And please like us on Facebook. Thank you very much. Have a good one. Thanks,
good night,
Ida.
You're welcome. Take care, Mr. Young. Wayne.
Okay.